I'm really going to enjoy, in fact, I am right now enjoying introducing this next individual. You know, a lot of people can maintain the mantle or the image of courage. But, you know, the greatest proof of courage is what men endure and continue to endure for their ideals and their principles. And I don't know of any better example of that than our next speaker. He's a relatively young man. He was born in 64, northwest of Frankfurt, Germany. He's a brilliant man. He studied chemistry and physics, and he was about ready to receive his PhD and begin a very storied career in that field. But his conscience and his intellect and his sense of desire for truth led him into the Holocaust question. And he verified the Luther Report in 1993. And ultimately, as a result of his freedom of conscience and his dedication to the truth above all things, and ultimately, really, to his people, because these things have direct bearing on your nation, his PhD was denied. He was sentenced to 14 months in prison. He endured 3 house searches. He lost his job and his home twice. Now, when the people who dominate our media and when George Bush talks about how free we are in the West and how unfree they were in Baghdad, I would hold up to them Mr. Gemmer Rudolph. When I was in Germany just 2 years ago, I went to Checkpoint Charlie Museum. And there they have exhibits of Germans who died fleeing the Soviet occupation, obviously, of East Berlin. They used many kinds of devices. Men, women, and children died in this quest for freedom. And all over the walls of this museum it says, "We came to the West, West Berlin and West Germany at that time, because we believed in freedom of conscience, the freedom of a man to speak his piece, to state what he believes without fear, openly and honestly, where government cannot dictate or suppress ideas and principles." Well, what is different than the current government of Germany and many European countries today and what's happening in Canada and what they want to do to America than what went on in East Germany? There is no material difference. Gemmer Rudolph, a man who loves his country, was forced essentially into exile, and he had to flee to Britain. In Britain, the laws there are too bearing down on those who have freedom of conscience, who just simply dare to question an historical idea, not based on hatred or intolerance, but simply because they love the truth. And then he was forced essentially to flee from Britain. In a very courageous and unorthodox move, Gemmer fled to the United States of America. Could be a mistake, Gemmer. And under our laws, because we take so many dissidents around the country, he applied for political asylum in our country. That's a brilliant move. And because this has been geared for the third world for so long, it takes years to process these cases. And now he's here in our country, and he has not let the grass grow under his feet. He has worked extremely hard. On this table back there, his books, you know, he got here first. That's his diligence. And because he got here first, he went to the table to the far rear. So a lot of you haven't got to, you've bought the other books before you've got down to his table. The books on his table mostly are books that he himself has published and reviewed and edited, not books that are just being sold from other organizations, people making a little money to finance their movement, which is not wrong. These are books that he published himself, a lot of what he wrote himself. For instance, he has been decisive in the work of a good friend of mine, Jürgen Graf, you know, who has written a lot of fantastic work on the revisionist issues of history from the Second World War and other revisionist issues. And I hope that each of you, when the conference is over, that you'll visit his table and help him support his work. You will see a couple dozen books that he's published in just the 3 years he's been here in this country, 4 years almost, in this country. So he's a fantastic individual. He's energetic. He's got a great journal, the Revisionist Journal, which you can subscribe to here. And I tell you, I believe that he's going to speak about he's going to give you an overview of the Holocaust controversy, which will help you in dealing with convincing new people about this vital issue of history. And I give you a man that we're thankful to have here in America. It's Germany's loss, Germer Rudolf. I'm sorry, we should have done that 2 hours ago. They promised it.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Let me first express my gratitude to have the chance to speak at this fine conference here, and continue by saying that my appearance here is actually anything else but business as usual. I'm not referring here to the fact that I've been subject to massive persecution in my country of origin, as David Duke just told you, which still today makes it rather difficult for me to actually remain a free man. What I'm referring to are actually two factors which almost convinced me initially not to appear here. The one was more of a sad story that some co-revisionist told me, don't appear here, he has been convicted, he has something done wrong. And I said, well, listen, what you know about David O. Duke's case comes from the media and from the courts. And as a revisionist, we all should know you never find the truth in the media and in sentences of courts. So I insisted on making up my own mind. Since I didn't know him personally, I wanted to talk to him personally. And I'm sure he will, and he promised that, publish all his paperwork documentation to show that he is innocent on the internet, that everybody can actually access it and find out that he really was put in jail unjustly. The second issue is actually more worrisome for me, and that is my current status here in this country. You might have heard or were told about the current situation with Canadian-German dissident Ernst Zündel, who is currently in jail in solitary confinement in Canada. And he was here having married a U.S. citizen, trying to get a U.S. citizenship, and because of a small glitch in his immigration issue, the authorities in this country took advantage of him and deported him, and Canada now holds him and try to keep him or deport him to Germany. I have applied for political asylum. The case will go on for years to come. The INS, that is basically Mr. Ashcroft, if it were the case would end as he wanted to, would end exactly the same as Ernst Zündel. The meaning of that is, if you look at Ernst Zündel's case, what they do right now with him, they come up with so-called evidence showing that he has been in the past associating with people that in turn have been associating with people that are claimed to have some strange extremist views. And because of that, and the evidence is secret and can't be challenged, and because of that, he's allegedly a threat to the national security of Canada. Now, if you take into consideration what the authorities and the media, what kind of a portrait, what kind of an image they have of you guys here, individuals as well as organizations presented, the cartoon that they draw of you, and of me as well, of revisionists, they say, see, now he's doing the same thing. He's now associating with these people, and the authorities might take an advantage of that. The threat for me to appear here is very real, that they can consider what I'm doing here as associating with people that in their eyes are considered to be evil, and the consequences of me could be that I end up in the gulag. So why am I here jeopardizing the tiny little pieces of freedom that I have left over? I actually want to tell you why I do it. First of all, the concept of guilt by association that is applied here is illegal under the state under the rule of law, this shouldn't exist. So if I bend to this pressure, if I say, okay, I don't do it because they could make the case, then I would, by acting, say what you are doing is right. And I am not agreeing with that, neither in words nor in action. So whoever I associate with, that doesn't mean that I hold the same views, whatever views they might be, but I have a right to associate with whomever I want. Now, the only way when I would say, okay, I refuse to talk to a certain crowd of people, that would require, because I don't like their ideas, that would require, of course, that I know the ideas of the people I'm going to talk to. I don't know your ideas. So what the government with that kind of policy right now in Canada and possibly here in this country, certainly in Europe, are doing it, is before I can safely speak to anybody, I have to politically screen this person. I have to snoop in all of your minds, find out what views you hold before I can safely conduct a conversation with you. Of course, if accidentally I am in the subway in Chicago and start up a conversation with some person there, fairness would demand I have to do it there too with everybody. That's ridiculous. That's really George Orwell, that's 1984. And I refuse to go there to politically screen anybody's views before I talk to people. And I'm not going to change that in this country. And that's the next point. I didn't do what I'm doing in order to eventually succumb to illegal pressure by authorities. I've been fighting this fight now for 10 years, standing up to my ideals, not to finally succumb just because the US authorities could put me under pressure like that. Of course, I've been myself repeatedly a victim of guilt of association and know what harm it does that people don't, even if they know me like relatives or friends, they know me, they know that what the media and authorities tell is not true, still they succumb. So I've suffered the negative side as a victim of guilt of association from people denying me, socializing with me. And because of that, I said, I cannot accuse them of doing wrong by refusing to associate just because somebody vilifies me. And then in turn, do the same to other people. I'm not going to associate with you because you could hold political views that I don't like. No, I'm not doing that. I want to decide myself if I want to talk to a person. And even if it turns out I totally disagree with a person for whatever reason, isn't that an ideal of this society, not to shun people because of different views, but to talk to them? And if I really think it's wrong, try to convince them and talk with them instead of ignoring them. These are the reasons why I'm here. And I'm not going into the question which opinions you hold or don't hold. But once for sure, even though I'm not trying to find out which views you hold, you are here tonight, this afternoon, to find out a little bit about my views. And so let me talk about things that might actually get you in trouble for associating with me. So what is revisionism about? Revisionism, in general, is not an ideology. It has nothing to do with politics. It is a concept, a mere method. It means revising the current picture we have when we talk about history in the face of new evaluation of evidence or new evidence. So it is just an attempt to make the writing of history more accurate. So it might sound rather boring, but the fact is, even though that is the job of every historians are some of the biggest whores of society, unfortunately, because there is no need for historians in the free market. Most of them are paid by governments, be they at university or colleges or at schools, and therefore they depend on the authorities, on whatever system is in there, so they pay attention to it, and that is a corruption of exact science.
Yeah, excuse me,
I have my projector. Okay. Can I have a person who actually changes the pieces so that I don't have to run over there? I just say, change the... This, okay. Oh no! Start with the first briefly. As you mentioned, I verified the Leisure report on the chemical and technical analysis of Auschwitz. I have the book over there. It translated in English after 10 years. Finally, the Rudolph report. also with an account of my persecution, if anybody's interested in my ordeals in more detail, 100 pages at the end of the book deal in detail with that. Okay. So you could put the next one up, please. Now there's a picture of a person that I just talked about, Ernst Zindel. That's when he was just... He's a dear friend of mine, and there he is sitting in the car of the U.S. authorities being just dumped over the border to Canada. You see it in his face, he's not very lucky. He's not very happy. All right, back to where I left off. Let me see. So... there is a need to actually hit the mainstream historians on the fingers because they are under a lot of financial, political pressure. The reason for that is political power. Okay, every political system and every society exerts pressure upon its historians to write history in a way that is favorable for it. Dictatorships might do it more bluntly and brutally than so-called republics, but the difference is only gradual. Historical revisionism is the force that resists and fights this pressure. Though in and of itself apolitical, historical revisionism thus has a profound political effect because it is always directed against the powers that be. It is always oppositional, if not outright revolutionary, in the cultural and social effect. However, I want all of you to keep in mind the power of revisionism lies in the fact that it is scientific, that it abstains from any attempt of becoming political itself, because only unambiguous factual statements backed up with hard evidence and free of any personal attack and biased interpretation have the power to potentially convince everybody. And that is what revisionism is about. We want to convince everybody, not just one certain political side of the spectrum. Let me now go a little closer to my real topic, Holocaust revisionism, a part of historical revisionism. This is only a small subsection, but certainly the most controversial one. Professor Robert Forreston, another very dear friend of mine, once stated that Holocaust revisionism is the intellectual atom bomb in the hand of the poor and powerless. He also said that the main sufferers under Holocaust propaganda, and thus the main beneficiaries of Holocaust revisionism, are the German people, but not the leaders, as well as the Palestinian people in its entirety. I think, however, that both statements are not very helpful as they do not really show the whole picture. Let me therefore draw a more complete picture. That is the book here that I published just this year on occasion of the 75th birthday of Robert Forreston. Revisionists from all over the world came together to follow an academic tradition of publishing a commemorative volume of articles just dedicated to a scholar who is famous and who deserves to be honored, and that was our contribution, and I was very happy to publish this book on my expense for my dear friend Robert. So let me draw a little bit of a bigger picture. First of all, who are the main beneficiaries of Holocaust propaganda and why? I follow my own line of arguments as laid out in a contribution that I had actually published in this small booklet, which my contribution is filled up also with a lot of humor because that's what I think everybody needs. And I have, to make my points, published a lot of cartoons along with the points I was making because revisionism with its political impact has been the target or the beneficiary of cartoons funny from one side or another. I divide the groups who massively benefit from the Holocaust myth into three groups. We can have the next one. A, that's the Zionists. The upper one, just show the upper. Well, you can show both, but the upper one. Now, what that means is very clear. What drives Israel, what keeps it afloat, are the gas chambers. They depend on all the support morally, socially, politically, and particularly financially, because they can depict themselves as the victim deserving of all protection no matter what. And this is a nice cartoon that actually kind of makes the point. Much more sophisticated and scholarly, it was actually published by Jewish American professor Norman Finkelstein in his book The Holocaust Industry, on where he shows how the Holocaust industry benefits from the Holocaust myth to drive the Jewish and Zionist power engine. But let me say that the Zionists does include most but not all Jews, but on the other hand also many Christians who have an irrational adoration for Jews as God's chosen people. There certainly are more Zionist Christians in the world than there are Zionist Jews, though Christians usually aren't as fanatic as Jews are. Now, why Zionism benefits from the Holocaust myth is obvious, as it gives Jews an aura of being morally unassailable, which is the pole position to gain control over other groups of people, as Professor Norman Finkelstein very well outlined in his book. Finally, most Zionist Christians are Zionists because they believe in the Holocaust, which turned the Jews as such and the modern Israeli state with them into a religious icon. The second group that benefits from the Holocaust dogma is international capitalism, which has an interest in breaking down borders both politically and fiscally as well as culturally and ethnically. Because every capitalist's profit rises if he can freely sell the same products everywhere in the world. The Holocaust is usually depicted as the logical outcome of right-wing ideologies, like National Socialism is depicted usually, as the ultimate result of nationalism and ethnic exclusivism. Thus, the Holocaust myth is the perfect weapon to fight any kind of national, speak right-wing independence, autarky, protectionism, any kind of cultural and ethnic identity and exclusivism. See, in the third group, all ideologies claiming that all humans are equal benefit from the Holocaust dogma. I call them egalitarianism, from égalité, French for equal. They have a wonder weapon, a miraculous weapon in the Holocaust myth, as it is the ultimate, quote, proof, unquote, of the absolute evil of any ideology which distinguishes between subsets of humanity. With the Holocaust as an argument, everybody dissenting with egalitarian views can easily be silenced by putting him into the context with the gas chambers. And now I give you a quote of something that I actually heard in the German state parliament while I visited it when I spent my time at the army. One of the left-wing delegates there said, "We all know," it was there about the question of if students have the same IQ, if they are all the same by nature, if we need a diversified school system paying attention to students not being equal but having different demands, or if we just need one school system that everybody gets the same education so that everybody actually gets the right, what they allegedly have a right to. The leftist said, "We all know where ideologies end, which claim that people are not equal. They end in the gas chambers of Auschwitz." That's what the ideology is wrapped up in a nutshell of how you can silence discussions about whether or not humans are equal or not. Because if you distinguish, well, these are different than those, and then the leftist says, yeah, that's what the Nazis did with the Jews. They said the Jews are different, and they ended up in the gas chambers. That's the chain of argument. So the ideology of egalitarianism, which is the driving force of leftist sociology and politics, becomes morally virtually unassailable with the gas chambers in the background. Although egalitarian ideology are usually opposed to international capitalism, they effectively support each other because the destruction of specific cultures and ethnic groups, identity against equality, is a goal of both ideologies. Leftist ideologies are also sometimes opposed to altruistic values, as soon as it is considered to be opposed to self-realization and emancipation, because altruism requires a feeling of identity. With a distinguished group and self-sacrificial behavior in favor of this group, and consequently, at least indirectly against other groups. International capitalism shares the intention to destroy identities and all ties to identifiable people, because the atomized consumer without identity, who has mere egoistic, materialistic, hedonistic so-called values, but no altruistic ideals anymore, can be manipulated very easily to lemming-like behavior, easy prey for any advertising campaign. Now, today, quite frequently already, it was mention of demographic problems that the white race is facing, and I'm going very briefly into that. Demographics show that the indigenous populations of Europe, as well as the white population here, is collapsing as a result of a hedonistic pandemic, which is flooding that continent with an intensity that goes parallel with the intensity of Holocaust propaganda. In 100 years, Europe will be depopulated of its original people and replaced by aliens, mainly from Asia Minor and Africa. North America is facing a similar situation, but it may be seen as a reconquista of the mestizos of people who have genetic links to the former Indians, American Indians. International capitalism brings the world to the brink of a worldwide ecological exhaustion and economic collapse. And soon beyond, mainly driven by a progressive redistribution of wealth from poor to rich, by both national in this country and international, caused by a monetary system based on public debt and interest on interest. Social unrest, perhaps even revolution, is unavoidable in the long run, in my view. Not that I want it, but I think it's unavoidable if things continue as they have been going on for years and decades. A way out seems impossible, as it requires radical new financial concepts, which had been successfully tested by the unspeakable regime that is claimed to have invented the gas chambers. So hush up, everybody, and keep running toward the cliffs. The next one. It's a nice cartoon that we have. There's the black sheep in the middle. It says, actually, excuse me, and running in the opposite direction. And the other caption of that cartoon says, the black sheep, a revisionist, refusing to run with a herd of lemmings, in that case it's sheep, and fall down the cliff. So give me the next one already. In the meantime, Washington's Zionist lobby has started to wage an eternal war in order to stabilize Israel, conquer Middle East petroleum sources, and support the crumbling international capitalist system's backbone, the U.S. dollar, by pure force and violence. It will all be in vain, as nobody can evade the mathematical law of exponential functions lurking behind public debt and a gigantic trade deficit. These are another nice cartoons just to illustrate the point. Now, the next one, I want to emphasize the mathematical laws of exponential function. Something that was talked about today already, that Americans don't produce anymore, but they import. What I show you here is the accumulated trade balance of the United States, and that is the one that goes down. And that's trillions of dollars. Every year it's $500 billion, and it's accumulating. That means the wealth of this country is slowly transferred abroad. So this country is being taken over by foreigners. Now, the good news is it's not even mainly China. Europe is actually the continent that sells the most products in terms of value into this country. And if you look into Europe, which country is, it's Germany. I've saw on the trade balance of Germany, plotted on the other side, it goes up kind of similar. So the country is slowly bought out by Germany. Might not be a disadvantage in the long run, but who knows. So what is the role of Holocaust revisionism in it? It is true that Holocaust revisionism cannot resolve any of the pressuring issue that I've just mentioned. What Holocaust revisionism does, though, is to challenge the moral and cultural hegemony of the dominant ideologies of Western society, whose deficiencies are the reason for the misdevelopments that I just outlined. If Holocaust revisionism succeeds, the moral and cultural hegemony of egalitarianism, internationalism, and Zionism collapses, because competing concepts can no longer be vilified that easily, if at all, and because all those who took advantage of the Holocaust for their political ends will face a situation where this will backfire, if not even blow up, right into their face. Although Holocaust revision is neither left nor right, neither German nor Jewish, neither internationalistic nor patriotic, it is always on the side of those who are suppressed. Be they Palestinians, be they Iraqis, be they German patriots, or any other group struggling to preserve their identity or even their mere existence. And I go so far as to state tomorrow it could even be Jews should their identity become threatened. Real threatened, not the imagination that they have now. I understand that many of you are worried about the future of the culture and ethnic European heritage in the United States. Although right now, European Americans are not yet a minority in this country and are not yet suppressed to a degree as it, for example, happens in Europe, particularly in my home country. It is certainly true that those who insist on preserving the mainly European heritage of this country argue against intermarriage and similar things, face massive opposition by the establishment. The reason for this is because such ideas oppose all three above mentioned ideologies: internationalism, egalitarianism, and Zionism. As such, Holocaust revisionism can be helpful to you. But please be aware that Holocaust revisionism is no tool exclusively at your disposal. It is also a potential tool of many nations in the world that struggled for their independence against economic exploitation by internationalist capitalism, the driving force of which is the United States. In addition, it is a potential tool of all other ethnic minorities in this country or in other areas of the world to preserve their heritage and resist attempts of assimilation. And last but not least, as an undermining force of the legitimacy of internationalism, Holocaust revisionism is also a potential tool to destroy the new empire called United States of America. This means, in clear language, by using Holocaust revisionism to further any political goals every American citizen saws on the branch of wealth he sits upon. Because most of American wealth currently depends on economically and ecologically exploiting the world. When this kind of new imperialism stops, American wealth will stop as well. And massive hardship will result for the majority in this country, at least until America has been restructured to a fairer, more social, more altruistic society. And I have heard some of you saying, yeah, we need to go through this depression, we need to go through this collapse before it can get any better. And I think that's true. To close this section of my presentation, let me summarize by saying that Holocaust revisionism in itself is and must be apolitical. However, the potential political impact of Holocaust revisionism is global in scale and revolutionary in depth. This impact would not just benefit a certain group, but potentially can benefit all those suffering under the powers that be, and that can potentially include something about 95% of the world population, primarily in the Third World, but also the poor and suppressed in the industrialized nations. I say this here because for a political struggle, everybody ought to keep the old Roman proverb in mind, divide et impera. We heard that today also. Divide and rule. If, however, you feel like you need to throw off a yoke of alien or hostile rulers, you need to apply the opposite principle, unita et libera, which means unite and liberate. You need to unite as many allies in a strategic alliance for your struggle against the powers that be, as many as possible. Otherwise, you will not succeed to liberate yourself. Therefore, you need to find common ground with other groups that suffer under the current situation. I've shown how Holocaust revisionism can potentially gain the support of 95% of humanity. Whites, yellows, reds, blacks, Americans and foreigners, Christian, Muslims, atheists, and even non-Zionist Jews. To get them all on board, this way we can win. Now to a much harder question. Now this is, I'm talking about Holocaust revisionism. You might have on other topics your own agenda where you don't think you can get these people on board. They have other issues and other interests. But when it comes to this issue that I'm talking about, many more people can be on board. And I personally have customers from all over the place. South Africa, the Arab world is a potential huge customer for me. Third world has a lot of interest because of their concept. They can see that revisionism has an impact on imperialism that can potentially liberate their country from all sorts of problems. So I speak potentially have to address audience all over the place. Now, the harder question is, how can Holocaust revisionism gain cultural hegemony in its field? My answer to this may surprise you, or perhaps even upset you, but here it is. we are assembled here, can do precious little to achieve this. And if revisionism goes mainstream, it will not do this because of any of us. And here's why. Two main characteristics of modern societies are they are highly structured, with each member having highly specialized tasks. B, they are information societies where the information is transported to a high degree by media controlled by the powers that be. Of course, we have the exception now with the internet, but remember, the internet basically is a huge heap of hay with some needles in there. And the statistical probability that people find the right thing and get it into the right part of their brain and process it properly is rather unlikely. The effect of this is as follows. In a highly specialized society, the expert in a certain field determine what is perceived as true and what is not. Most people have no other choice than to rely on expert advice, and rightly so. Therefore, as long as almost all Western historians subscribe to the established mainstream version of the Holocaust, the Western world will assume that to be the truth. To be the modern media, still today is dominated by TV. Most people, if they have the internet, they use it for looking up the weather, looking up movies that are looking up maps, and unfortunately for pornography. Don't expect people to go there and get politically enlightened, because hardly anybody does it. Can be changed in times of upheaval, it might change, but in normal times, at least today, I don't think that too many people use the internet, the potential it has. So TV, in combination with sophisticated psychology, leads to the unsurmountable fact that the vast majority will always believe what the news will tell them. And there will never be a way for us to compete with these trillion-dollar heavy mass media. Each drop of information that we bring into the public, to public attention, will be drowned in an ocean of disinformation by the media. When David Duke actually asked me to present a handy summary of revisionist arguments, I pondered for a while and I thought to myself, why should I do this? Well, the answer could be either to convince you because you yourself aren't convinced yet, which is perhaps not too likely in this audience, or in order to enable you to go out there and to tell the audience out there, the general public, whoever you meet, that our view is the right one. However, my experience in many presentations that I made for uninformed audiences is that I simply cannot convince a brainwashed crowd with scientific arguments presented in an hour or two, when they then simply go back home and expose themselves again for years to come to the Holocaust propaganda that's pouring out of the media. They might, for the minute or for a couple of hours, be convinced, yeah, there's something to it, but after a couple of days of exposure to the usual stuff, they have a relapse. My experience is also that only some 2 to 3% of any group of people are capable of critically out-of-the-box thinking, and it does not depend on the educational level. As a matter of fact, I would say the less educated people are, the more capable they are of doing that, because the smarter people think they are, the less likely they are to go out of the box, because they think they have already the truth. So the majority will always run with the crowd. And when it comes to the Holocaust, the crowd will run as the media tells them, and the media will report what the majority of experts, the historians, are saying. So does it mean that we're stuck forever with this gigantic lie? Nope, we are not. But the solution, in my opinion, does not lie in us revisionists trying to convince ordinary people on the road, or by trying to make futile counter-propaganda efforts to try to compete with the mass media. We just don't have the resources. Of course, I myself keep trying this, because I could be wrong with my analysis, and you should keep trying whatever you can in this agenda too. And of course, on the other hand, I need to sell my products to somebody, and therefore I need to address people and find new customers. That's a matter of economic survival and also of funding my own research that I'm doing. However, I do not have the illusion that we revisionists, by working that way, will ever turn this card around. The solution lies somewhere else, and it lies, in my eyes, in the only asset that revisionism really has, and that is exactitude. It was, again, the title of the one book that I had in favor commemorate my dear friend Forasson, Being Exact. Now, it is true that only those 2 or 3% of critical thinkers are promising candidates for our efforts, and that means 2 or 3% of historians when we start. They will hear, they will listen to good arguments, even if it is something completely different than the media tell them, or what other books and other experts have told them. But there is actually only one thing that is capable of convincing those critical historians. And they are critical historians and they are experts. And what is that? It is being highly accurate and superior in factual reporting of how it really was, to the point where they cannot help but to come around. And that is what I want to talk about now. Over the last 8 years, I have heard over and over again that Holocaust revisionism has explored all that there is to explore, that all relevant arguments have been made, that everything that the other side has said has been refuted 100 times, and that there's actually nothing left to be talked about or published about. All that needs to be done is wrap it up and get it out. Now, there's some truth to it that some blockbuster arguments of Holocaust revisionism has been around for decades. But I think there is some very severe misunderstanding. When I got involved into revisionism in 1990, I was actually struck by the lack of works that meet scholarly standard. Now, I've gone through myself through 10 years of Ivy League education in Germany in the exact sciences, and even though I didn't end up with my final degree, what I got is a good education of knowing what a scholarly work is supposed to look like. So hardly any of the revisionist works that I encountered there, according to my opinion, actually met that standard. And if it was met by an occasional work, the topic treated by it was just a tiny area of the whole topic. After all, the Holocaust spans an entire continent in distance, 5 years in time, and involved millions of individuals in hundreds of distinct places. We are not talking about one issue like the assassination of John F. Kennedy or something like that, where a few really good works can make it. We are talking about a huge issue here. So I started doing research on that topic in the mid-1990s, trying to organize scholarly work, actually going to archives or have scholars go to archives, finance it with my own means or fundraising. And we are collecting tens, if not hundreds of thousands of documents, doing forensic explorations of the actual sites on various places, and try to secure the evidence and get it all together. It was not before 1998 that the first result of that work was actually published, both in a magazine that I've been starting publishing since 97, as well as then starting with books. And I might say that even though it's now 6 years that I'm doing that, I would say we've just barely begun. It's an enormous work that is in front of us. If you just look at the standard Holocaust literature, which comprises some 60,000 volumes, most of them you can dismiss as not being scholarly. But even if only 1% of it is scholarly, there's still an amount of work that needs to be dealt with. I give you just one example to refute the claim that everything has been refuted by us. Let us just take one standard work of the other side. That is Danuta Cech's Calendarium of the Events of the Auschwitz Camp, a book of some 1,000 pages, almost 1,000 pages, that has been around since the 1960s, that has brought together thousands of documents on the Auschwitz camp, thoroughly claiming to document the extermination of Jews in Auschwitz. There has never been done anything by revisionists to actually take on that book and refute it. Now, Auschwitz is the core of the Holocaust, and this book is the standard work of the other side. And it wasn't even addressed by revisionists. So how can we say we have refuted everything? We haven't even started. We're working now on a book that keeps growing and frightens me, actually. It started out 2 volume, 800 pages. Now we are up to 2 volumes, 1,000 pages each. I might have to split it up in several volumes on just Auschwitz, of which we have collected tens of thousands of documents alone. A huge task to really bring it down to how it really was. Along the way, while we're doing this research, we covered other areas, because Auschwitz is such a huge camp that has involved all sorts of other camps and events all over occupied Europe during the Second World War. So in the meantime, we have kind of as a side effect, published monographies on other camps, like Majdan Ekstutov, Treblinka, and Bezek. It's just about to come out, so most books you can find over there. The Auschwitz work, the big one, will take another 3-4, I don't know how many years before we actually get it out. And the main reason why things progress so slowly, because you say I'm putting out 5-6 books a year, it's not slow. When I started this in 94, organizing and starting to publishing, I thought it's in a year or two and I'm going to be done with it. It's a lifetime work. And I don't know if I'm going to be done with it when I actually have to stop for whatever reason. The real reason is, of course, it's one is lack of funding. We all struggle with that. The other one is mainly the lack of researchers. Now, we have 6 billion people on this planet, and we have just one full-time researcher who does research on this topic. Just one out of 6 billion. And it's not me. I'm a publisher. There are several who do occasional work, but most people have to support themselves with doing some job, and so they cannot be full-time researcher. So we have only one person who does most of the workload. And that's why things progress rather slowly. One reason why that is so is, of course, persecution, because when you cannot make a living out of that, as soon as you start doing that, the authorities, particularly in Europe, where the main research is taking place, your existence is going to be trashed and you can't really make a living anymore and you have to find a job somewhere else. Some results of our ongoing research effort can be found in books that I published, and you can go back to look at it when I'm done. Now, does it have an impact, our approach of exactitude? And I will show you that now. Yeah, the second one. The next one is already up. The first sign that we were moving something was a book by a German government historian named Joachim Hoffmann that he published in 95. And I actually had the honor to get the rights to publish the English translation, which you can have there. It's on the German-Russian War. And by dealing with the German-Russian War, he had to deal with all sorts of propaganda claims that the Russians were making about German atrocities. And he found out that a lot of the claims were exaggerated, invented, or actually that the Soviets had committed crimes and blamed it on the Germans. He's documenting that, and while he was so doing, he tumbled over revisionist sources and innocently quoted them, not knowing what he was doing. He got in a hell of a trouble for that. He was threatened with prosecution, and just because the judge was a friend of his case got didn't make it to court. But he was told, if you change one word in the book, the case will be reopened and you will stand trial. So there are some weak sides when it comes to the hardcore revisionist argument in the book, and while I was editing it, I said, I can easily fix that. You write a little bit, put better quotes, better sources in there. He said, don't do it. You know perfectly what you do. You're an expert, and I accept and really admire what you're doing, but if you do that, I go to prison. Well, it may be exaggerated, but he certainly would be sentenced, and by that time he had already some problems with his health, a weak heart, and getting into any kind of prosecution, whether it ends in jail or not, would have killed him. Now, the second step, and we go to the next one, was a publication that appeared pretty much 2 years ago by a former leading editor of the biggest German news magazine, Der Spiegel. And he published in a small magazine called Osteuropa, that's Eastern Europe, that's a geopolitical magazine, an article reassessing the number of victims of Auschwitz. Currently, the Auschwitz administration of the Auschwitz Museum says it's 1.5 million. Publicly, they say that at their the plaques they have there. In their publications, they actually say 1.1 million. And he went to the trouble of trying to find out what really went on, and this guy came up that only 500,000 died. So he cut it in half, or even less than half. And the real revolutionary thing is not so much that he lowered the figure, but how he did it. He did it in saying that the crematoria that were built in Auschwitz didn't have the capacity to burn 1.5 or 1.1 million corpses. They could have handled a maximum 500,000 or 300,000, and the rest were burned in pits. And in order to prove why the crematoria didn't have the capacity, he quoted a book of mine that I had published 8 years before, saying, oh, this is an evil book, but this contribution is so good, and we can rely on it. Quite a breakthrough. And he said also, well, the places where the mass gassings are supposed to have happened, in certain rooms in the crematoria, it didn't happen there. It didn't take place. It happened somewhere else. Now, that was a revolution, too, because it confirmed basically the research most part of the research that I had done and for which I got sentenced. That is one of the leading editors of the leading news magazine in Germany saying that. So ever since, there's a battle going on between the Auschwitz Museum, who wants to keep the $1.5 million up, and this guy. And they had had some writings forth and back. It's going on in the internet. And he, when Friedhof Meyer, the author of this article, wrote a response to the director of the history department of the Auschwitz Museum, he again was relying on revisionist arguments, quoting all our sources, all our documents, without making a single reference to the publications that we had published it in. I figured it out only in 2002. He was a very loyal customer of mine ever since I started and collected and paid for everything. So I learned only when this appeared that he is the leading editor of Germany's biggest news magazine. So he's learning, and he's bringing it out. Actually, he wanted to publish it in Germany's biggest news magazine. And he was denied because they feared it could get them in trouble. So he kind of sneaked it into this small magazine there. The controversy is going on. I have a documentation of that controversy in my magazine, The Revisionist, where I've been following this. The next one shows you actually the book that I have translated into English now that this historian has quoted, Dissecting the Holocaust. It's perhaps the best summary of up-to-date revisionist arguments covering various camps, various alleged murder method, the problem of population statistics, several documents allegedly proving something, the problems of court trials, of eyewitnesses, and all these things. And one of these articles focuses on just the technical crematoria capacity of the crematoria in Auschwitz, and that's what he was quoting. Step three, to show you that we are slowly making progress, is a book that just appeared, if you could put the next one on, by German mainstream historian Professor Werner Maaser. It just got published last month. I haven't received it myself, but I spoke to a publisher friend of mine in Germany who had read it. And Maaser actually piggybacked a little bit on the publications of Meyer, and he goes even a step further. He just doesn't only quote one article in one of my books, but he repeatedly quotes my magazine, saying again, well, it's a bad right-wing publication, but I have to quote it because they publish all these documents, and that's the only place you can find them, and in this regard, they're reliable. So this is actually what you see on the surface. Now you know it from icebergs. What the tip you see on the surface over the water is only a small part. For years, I've been in touch with several historians, directly or indirectly. Professor Maaser was one of them. He was been given information over now 8 years, and it took him 8 years to get the courage to finally come up with something. Hopefully we get him to go further. And there are other historians who are sitting there who start helping us, working in the background, assisting us. So, slow progress. And to be honest, I don't care if they make proper references. Proper behavior, scientific behavior, would be if you refer to a publication, to a document, you give proper reference where you got it from. If somebody was the first one to publish it, you give them credit. Of course, they don't do that. And if they do it, they vilify you at the same time. But to be honest, I'm not into it about honor, about being recognized, about anything. As long as the historians finally do what is their duty and get the facts straight, that's all I want, and I'm happy with that. Now, what we can experience in Germany is the first phase of reorientation, the preparatory phase of a historiographical revolution, a revolution of writing of history. I'm sure that it will spread because I will dig in my heels into the soil of this country in order to keep publishing in the new lingua franca so that the entire world can find out about the mother of all lies as created and abused by the powers that be. So far, I've talked almost exclusively about politics. However, since I do not want to disappoint those of you who have expected a little bit of revisionism by content here, I will comply with David's wish and will give you a short guideline of how to approach Holocaust revisionism when you are actually confronted with the normal people out there. And again, it might not be what you expect it to be. Because I'm not going to give you a handy summary of the most striking revisionist arguments. One reason is because, as I said already, I came to understand that people who are confronted with a massive broadside of revisionist arguments usually react opposite to what we want them to. They consider us to be zealots at best or neo-Nazis at worst. Most of you who have tried it might have experienced that. However, if you really want to have a nice handout with a very concise summary of arguments, I have a flyer over there, The Holocaust Controversy, which I hand out for free. And it gives a nice introduction about what revisionism says and what it does not say, and short references to some arguments. And if you want the real broadside of top-notch revisionist scholarship, it's the book we just had on Dissecting the Holocaust, which you can buy over there. So, as I mentioned before, I have some experience with various groups, with various attempts of actually addressing people who have no idea, who have been force-fed by media and politics for decades, and trying to get them to ultimately listen to our arguments. And the most successful approach during my 12 years of experience now, I figured out just half a year ago, I would say, at least the most successful so far. We're always trying to improve it. And that is about the very simple question that I might summarize: when did Holocaust propaganda start? I'm not saying it that way, because if you use the word propaganda in the context with a normal man, they all really freak out. The question that I would ask them: since when do we know that 6 million were about to be killed or were killed? 6 million Jews. Whatever their result is, I give you the result actually beforehand. I get them a step-by-step backward. Was it 1946, 45, 42, 41? The real answer at the end of my introducing them, since when we know, is 1900. We know it since 1900. Why do we know it? If you can give me the next one. This is a book that I published summer last year, and I'm most proud of. Actually, Don Hedesheimer, the author, was investigating claims made by Jewish organizations during and after the First World War. The First World War, not World War II, the First World War, saying that 6 million Jews in Europe and Eastern Europe are suffering, are about to experience a Holocaust. He published a preliminary article about that in the Barnes Review, that's published by my friend Willis Caro, in 1998, I think it was. I published a German translation shortly thereafter in my magazine. And he had a presentation of that extended in depth at a Cincinnati conference of David Irving, I think it was in 2000. I was so fascinated by the material he has uncovered from news media reports of the 1910, 1920s, that I immediately made a book contract with him then. It took me 3 years to get it out, which was basically because Don never had written a book and he didn't know how to go about. So, and I was pretty much in trouble during that time too, didn't have a real home, was wandering around. But finally I got it out. Now what follows now, I want you to keep in mind, is basically the result of Don Hedesheimer's research. The subtitle of the book is very telling already. It says, "The First Holocaust: Jewish Fundraising Campaigns with Holocaust Claims During and After World War I. So the title explains a lot. The question is, since when do we know? I've just mentioned Joachim Hoffmann, who came up with the fascinating news that the Soviets were already, towards the end of the Second World War, making the propaganda claim 6 million Jews were killed by the Germans. Now, at that time, they didn't even have liberated the Auschwitz camp. So they could not possibly know anything, but the 6 million figure was up then. You could go steps back. You find claims in the New York Times as early as late 1942, where they're already talking about 6 million are about to die, half of them are killed, the rest of them are going to be killed. There's another quote in 1936 when Chaim Weizmann was interviewed by the Peel Commission that was supposed to decide about the fate of Palestine, whether or not to divide it between the Arabs and Israelis already at that time. And Chaim Weizmann then said, well, there are 6 million suffering Jews who are going to be exterminated in Europe, and therefore we need to have Palestine. It was 1936, so there was nobody claiming that anything was going on. Don Hedesheimer basically took the New York Times between 1916 and 1927 looking for articles, and he found a massive amount. And you have a couple of quotes here that I kind of clipped out of New York Times articles, 6 million starving, to save 6 million men and women in Eastern Europe. An estimated more than 5 million are actually starving, but the life of 6 million humans, the suffering of 6 million humans, and so forth. And the one article that's on top mentioned the crucifixion of Jews must stop. It mentions a Holocaust, 6 million extermination. These buzzwords during that time reoccur again and again. If we take the next one, that's perhaps a document that some of you have seen. It was published in 1919 by Martin Glynn, who was a governor of the state of New York just at the end of World War I. And in it, it says, from across the sea, 6 million men and women call to us for help. 6 million human beings. 6 million men and women are dying. Women are dying. In the threatened Holocaust of human life, 6 million famished men and women. 6 million men and women are dying. So I condense it now to the buzzword sentences that are in this article. Hedesheimer, in his book, actually also proves that these claims of suffering are not true. With population statistics and other things, he shows that during and after the First World War, basically all populations in Middle and Eastern Europe suffered tremendously, loss of population because of war, disease, and everything. The only subsection of these societies that kept growing in wealth and multiplying were the Jews. The money where it went, actually, that was raised with these fundraisers, a lot of it went to Soviet Russia. Now guess what they did there with it? It was basically a fundraising for the Jewish revolution in Russia. That's how the Jews in New York perceived it initially, and by 27, 28, they figured out that this got out of hand and it's going to backfire on them, and then they stopped the campaigns. But that was what most of it was about, because they thought it's a Jewish project, we support the Jews there, help them set up their own kolkhoz or whatever they call it, and their own area. Now, showing these things, showing people that Holocaust propaganda is much older than World War II, is a real eye-opener for most people. After such a revelation, most people will accept the possibility that things could be fishy. But I'm not going to stop here. I go another step further, because there's another series, another parallel to a century of almost uninterrupted Holocaust propaganda, and that's related to gas chambers. If we take the next one, the first one was published in the British Daily Telegraph, who was the main carrier of British war propaganda against the Germans during the First World War. On March 22nd, 1916, on page 7, in the middle of World War I, this article appeared, "Atrocities in Serbia." Now let me read the decisive passages from it. "According to reliable information, the victims of the Austrians and Bulgarians exceeded 700,000. Women, children, and old men were shut up in churches by the Austrians and either stabbed with bayonet or suffocated by the means of asphyxiating gas." They have the claim of mass gassings of 700,000 people. Of course, after the First War, everybody assumed that what the British were doing there is black propaganda, and nothing true. Nothing whatsoever was true about that. Interesting enough, if we go to the next one, I juxtaposed this article with an article that appeared in the very same newspaper, the Daily Telegraph, again, on June 25th, 1942, on page 5. Now, this is 5 days before the New York Times brought the very first reference in a small article that Jews are being exterminated in Germany, or in German-occupied areas. So what we see here is the first clipping of claims of mass extermination of Jews by Germans. Same newspaper, same amount of people, Germans murder 700,000 Jews in Poland. This time it's Poland, and it's Jews. It's no longer Serbs in Serbia, but it's Poland's Jews in Poland. "Traveling gas chambers, more than 700,000 Polish Jews have been slaughtered by Germans in the greatest massacre in world history." Of course, we all know, if I speak to a normal audience, this time it's true. The first time it was propaganda. Accidentally, it's just the same newspaper that is known to carry black propaganda. Accidentally, it's the same amount, again, 700,000. Accidentally, it's the very first media information that we get about that event. But this time it's true. Well, maybe, maybe not. Of course, I go on and say, They might have made that in the First World War, and if you read mainstream historians, you see it backfired in the First World War, because afterwards the British were exposed of having invented all these lies, and they didn't do it anymore in the Second World War because they knew it's going to backfire on them. So all the stuff that came out in British magazines and whatever, and newspapers, is actually true, because they wouldn't have dared to lie again after they were caught once. So ever since, we must assume that reports about gassings, mass gassings, or preparation of mass gassings of Jews are either true in the Second World War event, or would never be dared by the media again if they were not true. So if you think that nowadays nobody would dare in the mainstream media to make claims like Germans produce Zyklon B to kill all Jews or assist the Iraqis to kill all Jews, now I teach you better on that one with the next. Let me bring two examples. The first one, it is both actually are from America's first war against Iraq to drive Iraqi troops out of Kuwait. You might know that was 1991. That is the New York-based Jewish press, then calling itself the largest independent Anglo-Jewish weekly newspaper. February 21st, 1991. Iraqis have gas chambers for all Jews. Or take the front cover announcement of Volume 12, Number 1 of Spring 91's of Response, which is the periodical published by the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Fall Center, my German tongue tumbles, with a TH, in Los Angeles, and distributed all over America with in 380,165 copies, as they claim on the cover. There you read on the front cover, Germans produce Zyklon B in Iraq, and they show a picture of Iraqis' German-made gas chamber. And inside it says that the Iraqis are producing poison gas to kill vermins and Jews with the help of the Germans. Of course, we know in 1991 it was again all invented, don't we? For sure. And accidentally it comes so that there was another war against Iraq and there were claims that Iraq possesses weapons of mass destruction that were threatening Israel. So that's the Jews and America, even though Zyklon B, according to mainstream historiography, is a weapon of mass destruction against Jews. Zyklon B in that context wasn't mentioned. We now know, of course, to whose benefit this war was fought after several high-profile people in American politics even admitted it, but we don't have to go there because Israel's renowned newspaper, Haaretz, proudly proclaimed on April 7, 2003, and I quote, "The war in Iraq was conceived by 25 neoconservative intellectuals, most of them Jewish, who are pushing President Bush to change the course of history." Senator Fritz Holling's statement was already mentioned today, just recently on May 21st, proclaiming proudly that, of course, we all know this war was fought for Israel and nothing else. Because, as we all know, the Jews in Israel really deserve preventive protection from annihilation by weapons of mass destruction, Zyklon B or not, invented or not. So with just this line of argument, stretching over almost 100 years of continuous Holocaust propaganda and gas chamber propaganda, that I've put in this small paperback just for $10, which does not even touch directly upon the Holocaust as such, at least not in a way that I'm doubting that. It's like, well, this time we know it's all true. It was just a lie then, before, and then, afterwards. Just this one single occasion, it was all true, and we are morally absolutely not allowed to doubt anything about it and look into it. But if you show people this line of, this chain of arguments, these documentations, I can guarantee you it is blows their mind and it opens their mind and allows them to doubt there can be something fishy. And you yourself haven't, with one single word, challenged anything about their views on the Holocaust. They do it themselves. And that's what we have to get them to. They have to do it themselves. If we try to force them to change their mind on this topic, as dogmatic as they are about it, it's probably backfiring. But with that approach, I had enormous success. So, I think I'm actually at the end of my talk with that. So what I, unfortunately, the two documents that I have given you at the end, which actually blows everybody's mind about the Iraqi war, see, oh, there I edit again. I haven't gotten them reproduced in my current edition, so I'm waiting to be able to sell the edition I have now to get out a second edition with these documents in there. And this book can be summarized into an article or even a flyer that is short, and that is what I think I'm going to do. This kind of stuff you can give into the hands of people and can still prove, yeah, the Holocaust, that one was true, but it was a lie there and a lie there, and the people start to think, well, perhaps that's strange. Let's look into it. So if you want to do something about it, that is probably the way to go. Thank you.
Wow. Now, I know most of you aren't used to a college lecture, but that was quite a lecture. And the man's a great intellect, but not only does he have an intellect, he's got courage to match it, and I appreciate him. And it took a lot of courage for him to come to this event and the political incorrectness of this event. And I think one thing this event is doing and creating is a new paradigm. It's really a new value system that European Americans are no longer going to censor their thoughts, their ideas, their principles, and that we are going to stand up forthrightly for what we believe, and we are not going to back down on those principles.